Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. Today, I'm happy to have Joe Pastor joining me for this review of one of the CSB, Chemical Safety Board's, recent incident investigation reports. So today, we're going to be talking about their review of the Foundation Food Group incident that happened at their Gainesville, Georgia facility on January 28th, 2021. So, Joe, welcome. And why don't you tell us a little bit of background about Foundation Food Group and their facility?
Sure. Thanks, Molly. So, Foundation Food Group is a poultry processor. They came about after a merger in 2020. And again, this incident that we'll be talking about today happened January 28th, 2021. So, at the time that the incident occurred, there were 135 employees that worked at this building where the incident happened. And this was building four. And it housed five production lines where they were freezing poultry. And so that's who Foundation Food Group is. So again, they're the ones that owned the facility. Another player that we'll talk about today is Messer. They are an industrial and specialty gas technology and applications supplier, and they work within the food industry, obviously, like in this case, but also industrial, medical, chemical, and electronics industries. So in this particular case, they were supplying the bulk liquid nitrogen that we'll talk about today that was involved in this incident. And they also designed and owned the liquid immersion freezer system, which was the technology in use in this building that was involved in the incident. And they leased it to Foundation Food Group in order for them to freeze their poultry products. So prior to 2020, this particular facility was using ammonia freezer systems. And after the merger, they wanted to increase their production capacity. So that's when they introduced the Messer liquid nitrogen freezer systems instead. And so they worked together for a while to get this system up and going. They installed some bulk storage outside so that they could have that liquid nitrogen for use in the process. They installed the freezer in May of 2020. And they put it into service later that month, and that was on line two. And then later, in July, they added a third bulk storage tank and liquid nitrogen freezer on line four. And that's the one that ended up being involved in this incident. So they installed this and started up on line four in December, so December 5th of 2020. And then the incident occurred the next month. They did add walls to the line four freezer room to separate it from other areas of the plant. And we'll kind of get into how some of the layout ended up contributing to the event a little bit. That room ended up being below grade from some adjacent rooms, so not a good area to have a liquid nitrogen leak. And then this is a fairly common technology in the food industry because it's got a low capital investment, a smaller size, better freezing time compared with the ammonia-based mechanical freezers. So this did make sense from a business standpoint for them to make this change from the ammonia to the liquid nitrogen technology. However, it's liquid nitrogen, despite the hazards that it poses, it's not really defined as a highly hazardous chemical. Right. So it's not currently covered by PSM or RMP. And so therefore, Foundation Food Group was not required to implement a PSM program, and they didn't really do any pieces of it voluntarily either. So we'll talk more about those. And then one other player we'll mention, mostly when we get to some updates on what's happened since and some recommendations, is Gold Creek Foods. And that's because they acquired Foundation Food Group post-incident. So those are the players and kind of some background as to what was going on at the time. So Molly, let's get into what specifically happened.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's quite a cast of characters for this one. Mm-hmm. So What happened is that they had a level instrument in the immersion freezer that was damaged. And the type of technology that they used was a bubbler style level device. So basically it sends a very small flow of a gas, usually inert gas, nitrogen in this case, through a little tube down underneath the liquid level. And it's checking the pressure differential between the flow through that tube under the liquid level and what the pressure is in the headspace above the liquid level. And it uses that pressure differential to infer what the level is of the liquid in the device. So they had this level instrument, this bubbler, in the immersion freezer in the liquid nitrogen section. And unfortunately, the tube got bent such that it was, instead of bubbling that flow of nitrogen underneath the liquid to measure the liquid height above it, it got bent so that it was discharging into the headspace. So there was no differential pressure between the gas going through that tube and the headspace. So it took that to mean there was no level in the system. So the control system thought that they had run out of liquid nitrogen in the system, and so it opened the flow fully. That led to an overflow of the system because it just kept pouring in there given a faulty reading. The nitrogen quickly vaporized, filling the room. As you mentioned, the room was kind of sunken below some of the other workspaces. So it developed essentially like a 5-foot deep pool of vaporized nitrogen in there, which resulted in a oxygen deficient atmosphere. Nitrogen makes up a large percentage of air. However, we still need oxygen to breathe. So when that nitrogen displaced the oxygen, it was a fatal environment. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, two maintenance workers that had been servicing that particular freezer at the time of the overflow incident were killed through asphyxiation. The building was eventually evacuated, but due to some confusion and lack of awareness that we'll get into later in the podcast, at least 14 other Foundation Food Group employees responded to the freezer area to try to determine what happened or attempting to rescue their coworkers. Of the employees that responded to that area, 4 additional employees were fatally injured, and 3 others were seriously injured. It's very unfortunate. It reminds me a lot of confined space entry incidents mm-hmm. where somebody thinks they're trying to do a helpful thing, and unfortunately they fall victim to the same problem. Additionally, 4 out of 5 emergency responders who entered the building wearing SCBA, the breathing apparatus, were also transported to the hospital after experiencing symptoms of asphyxia. Fortunately, they were all treated and released. So in total, 6 fatalities out of this incident. So that was not very good at all.
Yeah, that was a very, very sad day, very unfortunate event. And like you mentioned, the 2 workers who were initially killed were maintenance workers, and they had shut down the line and sent all the line workers on break because they were having some issues with refrigeration in this line. And so they were attempting to troubleshoot it while the room was just filling with nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the workers were confused. Are we going back? What's going on? And that's right. When there was confusion about where everybody was, where mm-hmm. they were supposed to be. And yeah, like you mentioned, quite a few employees attempted to go into this room to see what was going on and or to attempt rescue efforts. So exactly. A very confusing time for sure. So mm-hmm. one of the things that we want to talk about next is just why is liquid nitrogen so hazardous?
You would have thought this would have been safer than the ammonia system that they were working with, but
right.
It has its own hazards.
Definitely. So it's colorless, it's odorless, it's non-flammable, non-toxic. It's an inert gas that, as you know, is abundant in air. But the issue that we get into is when the concentration is just so much higher than oxygen. And that's where you really get into trouble there. So it boils at -320 degrees Fahrenheit at atmospheric pressure. And it does produce large volumes of gas when it vaporizes. And I thought this was really interesting. This just seems like a crazy big number to me. liquid nitrogen has a liquid to gas expansion ratio of 1 to 696 at 7 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you have, you know, like a gallon or something like that of liquid nitrogen, well, it's going to expand to 696 gallons worth of gas in the room. So we can see how even a small amount could create a really big problem when it vaporizes. Yes. And of course, it readily mixes with air at room temperature. But if it's colder, then it's denser than air. And that's where it collects in the low areas and creates that cloud that you talked about that was like 4 or 5 feet tall.
Right.
And it's very, very cold. So it can cause cold burns, frostbite, hypothermia. And then, of course, the biggest issue is that it displaces oxygen. And so anytime you've got below 19.6% oxygen in a room, that's where you start causing some adverse effects. But they're not too bad. But then when you get to, you know, below 12.5% oxygen, that's where you've got poor judgment, poor coordination. You start to have impaired breathing. But when you have less than 10% oxygen, that's where you can just, you know, immediately lose consciousness and death without warning. You don't really even know what's happening from asphyxiating, and you can do that in just one or two breaths. So,
So it's not something that you can get in there and realize, oh, this is problematic. Let me get out.
Right.
You get in there and take a breath or two and it's too late if the concentration is low enough.
Right. Yes. And of course, we're talking about when you're not monitoring it at all. You would have no idea what the concentrations are in the room. So let's get into the root cause of the incident. I know you talked to us a little bit about the bubbler before, but there's some more details that we want to get into that the report spelled out for us.
Right. So as I mentioned before, the tip of the bubbler got bent so that it was above the normal liquid level, and it was always showing a 0% level. So that fooled the control system, and it thought it needed to keep putting liquid nitrogen in to maintain its target set point. Unfortunately, there was also a high-level safety interlock that would shut down the system if the liquid level got too high. Unfortunately, that safety interlock was triggered off of the same instrument, the same bubbler tube, that was doing the process control. So that one device messed up the routine process control and the safety interlock. So one failure took out two methods of control, which is how they ended up with the overfill. After the incident, the CSB did credit Messer with having made substantial changes to their freezer design, addressing these instrumentation design concerns. Messer decided to modify the bubbler design using stronger tubing to try and prevent it from getting bent out of position, and they added a second level device. Another bubbler, but at least a secondary independent device that would trigger the safety interlock system so that they were independent. They also provided a temperature sensor, an RTD, on the freezer inlet that would detect the presence of the cryogenic liquid nitrogen that was yet another safety interlock system that would shut off if they started having an overflow. So there were some significant failures with this single level device, and it was a very poor design for that type of system.
Yeah, there were a couple of things I thought that were kind of interesting about this part of the report. Did you see the part where it says that the bubbler should have had two brackets and only had one? So that could have contributed to it bending out of shape. And then they also did some testing and they weren't able to like replicate an exact like bubbler damaged to the point that the one was in this case. So I thought that was really interesting because they were kind of trying to like postulate what could have bent it and like how exactly, if it was on purpose or on accident through like troubleshooting, if it was part of like
these little bubbler devices tend to use very small tubing, you know, maybe a quarter inch tubing is fairly typical. And so if you think of a small metal tubing, you know, maybe the size of your pinky finger, it could very well get bumped and adjusted out of position. And when it's critical that it go at a particular physical location to get your level reading, yeah, you need to make sure that that's not going to get wiggled around and bumped into. And so it was kind of hard for the CSB after the fact to determine the specific mechanism, but it was clear when they looked at it after the incident that it was out of position, which was very unfortunate.
Yeah, definitely. And they even got as specific as looking at the quality control checklist. Mm-hmm. And there is an item that says check that all support clamps are in place. And one of the technicians, I guess, indicated that because of where it was listed in the checklist, you wouldn't have been looking at the bubbler at that point.
Right.
So it was,
right.
Really,
it was all closed up by that point, so you couldn't see exactly. It. So they had to just assume it was, which
right.
is always a bad position to be in.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And then Messer even completed a survey of 14 additional immersion freezers like this because they just wanted to see if any of these bubbler tubes were damaged or bent. And they actually discovered 2 additional damaged bubbler tubes. And they didn't find any others with just one single support clamp. So that was very interesting as well.
Yep.
But we want to next talk about their PHA. So what about the PHA?
Right. Yeah, we always harp on the fact that PHAs are designed to identify risks. And they had some particular problems with theirs. So what did they find?
Yeah, definitely. So they did do a PHA on the freezer system. And it didn't identify the fact that if the bubbler failed, that it would also render the high-level alarm and interlock non-functional, which is what you said before. So not only is your level reading wrong, but because it's wrong, it's not going to trigger any sort of interlock. So that should be something that's identified in a PHA, but it wasn't. They also incorrectly assumed that there would be additional safeguards, like atmospheric monitoring outside the freezer, which that's a good assumption to make because that's a best practice, but
right.
it was an incorrect assumption to make because they didn't have those.
Right.
You'd hope
PHA was done by the precursor to Messer when they designed this technology. I think it was Lindy.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, just made some assumptions on how it would be installed, which led to some of these errors.
Yes, definitely. They also grouped together several causes for a single deviation, so that kind of made it hard to understand which safeguards were still going to be effective. And then in this case, they grouped these together, and so it wasn't obvious that the high-level alarm safeguard wouldn't be effective in this case because the bubbler would be damaged. That was one of the deviation causes.
Right. Yeah, they had like a malfunction of the bubbler grouped in with a malfunction of a temperature control system and improper calibration and so forth. So it was really hard to tell what was going on. If, for instance, you were looking at the malfunction of the temperature control system, then the level would have been a valid safeguard. If you're looking at malfunction of the bubbler, then obviously the level device isn't going to be a safeguard because that's your failed cause. So,
right.
Yeah, it was a little bit jumbled and made it really difficult to follow.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And like you mentioned, they could have improved upon the PHA because the cause that they identified was really not specific enough. There could have been many ways that the bubbler could fail, and they really should have investigated each of these because they would all have different frequencies and relevant safeguards. So they really just needed to be a lot more meticulous in their approach mm-hmm. to like every scenario that could have
right.
could have happened.
Yeah, some level devices like a radar level or float type of thing, it's a single device, and you know, a failure of that level instrument makes sense. But when you're talking a bubbler, as I said, you're sending a small flow of gas through this little tube, and then you have pressure transmitters in the headspace and on the gas line. There are a lot of components to that that, you know, certain failure modes may respond differently. And so that's why the complexity of that style instrument warranted a lot more detail.
Exactly. Yes. So, you know, good PHA has got to have specific cause consequence pairs. And so you may have a bunch that are very similar, but you really have to evaluate them independently. And unfortunately, that just was not done by Lindy. So that is what we can tell you about their PHA. So it was done, but it was definitely inadequate in a few ways. Now, there were some other contributing factors. So what else did the CSB find, Molly?
Yeah, we mentioned it a little bit earlier, but the area monitors, monitoring for the oxygen content in the room. When you're dealing with cryogenic materials or inert gases like nitrogen or argon and things of that sort, it's really important to have sensors to detect if you've got some loss of containment so that you know that the air is still sufficiently breathable. And for those sensors, you really need to have audible and visual alarms that are always monitored so that somebody can tell. As you mentioned before, obviously the nitrogen is colorless, so you're not going to be able to look in through a window and tell that you have a problem. Now, in this case, they actually could because it was so cold. Some of the people saw a white cloud, but that apparently wasn't unusual. Sometimes it's just so cold, you've got some condensation in the room and it creates a little bit of a fog. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't realize that this nitrogen fog was different than, you know, condensation fog. So when you've got situations like that, it's really essential that you have an area monitor to detect. And the PHA had gone on the assumption that you had these in place, but unfortunately they were not there. Messer had some references that they provided indicating that they should have area monitors, but there wasn't any clear requirement or pre-startup checklist for Foundation Food Groups to implement these. There are a lot of industry guidelines that are out there as well recommending these area monitors, but unfortunately that fell through the cracks.
Yeah, I did see that in the report there's a spot that says that Messler notified Foundation Food Group three times, at least in writing, that they were able to find that they needed to have these monitors. But as you said, it didn't stop them from, you know, continuing to lease this equipment to them. It didn't stop them from preventing startup. So there were lots of missed opportunities where people identified that this was definitely something that they should have had when dealing with liquid nitrogen, but they just didn't have any monitors.
Which is unfortunately, and six people paid the price with their lives. So
yeah.
It was unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And another thing that was a contributing factor, which we see a lot in these incidents, is emergency response. So Foundation Food Groups actually didn't have a plan for a liquid nitrogen release. So they didn't train their employees on how to recognize it was happening, how to respond to it. They also didn't communicate or coordinate with any outside emergency response people that they called upon for assistance. Mm-hmm. And so those are definitely big no-nos. You want to make sure that you've got a plan for any scenario that could happen at your facility. And then, of course, if you're going to rely on any outside emergency response personnel, you also need to make sure they know what they're dealing with as well. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, they didn't do any drills related to a liquid nitrogen release. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't really educate their employees at all on how to attempt rescue and what kind
or not attempt PPE. Rescue.
Right, exactly. They just had no idea that that wasn't something that they should even attempt. They were very unaware of the hazard that that posed. And they did have an emergency action plan. Again, not one for this specific scenario, but the one that they did have was in English, but English was not the primary language for many of their employees. So it's difficult to know how informed they were of the emergency action plan pieces that they did have. And so, of course, all of these failures significantly increased the impact of this incident because, like we said, it started with two initial deaths from the maintenance workers who were actually working on that line at the time. But then through the course of all the response, we ended up with four additional fatalities and three injuries associated with like rescue and things like that. Now, the new owners of the facility, Gold Creek, they have made significant improvements to their emergency response plan. And I do like that the CSB included that in their report. Right. Sometimes we don't know what happens later, or sometimes facilities totally shut down, so we don't really see any improvements. Mm-hmm. But they did note that Gold Creek now has an emergency action plan specific to this type of release. And they do have those written in English and Spanish. So that's good that that's fit for their work.
Right. I think actually the Gold Creek, they have since changed their freezing technology, and I don't think they're using the liquid nitrogen at this point, but they did make significant improvements to their emergency response plan, which was a very good follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, definitely. Yeah, another item that was brought up as a contributing factor was the emergency stop buttons. They did have 10 e-stops provided for that immersion freezer. Unfortunately, they were all positioned very close to the freezer in different spots. The CSB was unable to determine the information from the maintenance that was occurring when the overflow happened, and if it happened so quickly that the two maintenance workers were unable to reach them, or if they tried to really reach them or not, because unfortunately they died and they were unable to get that information. But it was very clear from the positions that no one without PPE could access those e-stop buttons once the overflow occurred because they were too close. They would have had to have gone into the danger zone to reach those buttons. The liquid nitrogen flow was eventually shut off maybe an hour or so after the incident occurred, but they had to go to the outside bulk storage tanks and close a valve there to stop it. So the CSB noted that they should have had emergency stop buttons positioned near the entrances and exits of the room. As you mentioned before, they added walls to segregate this freezer from some of the other production areas. And so it makes sense when you have an emergency stop, you want it near the equipment. If somebody is there, they can hit it immediately, but you also want it near the exits. So if they are making a rapid exit, they can hit an e-stop button on their way out to safety, or have it near an entrance to the room or area of the hazard so that somebody can hit an e-stop before they get into the danger zone. So that was another finding that the CSB had. And then next up is our favorite about PSM programs.
Yes.
What did they find there?
Yeah, and I thought the CSB did a good job in their report. They talked about how like process safety has become so synonymous with the PSM standard that people don't necessarily think about it when they don't have to comply with PSM. And so in this case, nitrogen is not on the list of covered chemicals for PSM or for RMP. So they weren't required to have a process safety program under those requirements, but they really should have had programs in place to address process safety, even if it wasn't, you know, uppercase PSM. That could have really helped to prevent and limit the impact. So specifically, the CSB mentioned that if they had had better process safety culture and leadership responsibilities, that could have led to more oversight of the program. And they actually noted that they had some positions within safety management that were vacant for, I think, like a year leading up to the incident. So if you think about how no one was specifically focused on these process safety issues for that amount of time, well, definitely could have contributed.
I think they had filled that role shortly before the incident, but it was vacant during the time that they were doing this conversion from the ammonia to the liquid nitrogen and that entire capital project implementation. So
yeah,
that was a shortcoming.
Definitely. And then in regard to their PHA, like we mentioned before, they did have one performed by the vendor, but it wasn't really done with the specific installation in mind. And so it didn't include any personnel from Foundation Food Group. So they weren't able to account for like the location of the emergency stops, anything like the location of the room being a little bit lower and it being walled off. So the PHA just really missed a lot of the specifics of where this equipment was going to be used. So it's good that the equipment vendor did a PHA, and that's a good practice for like the design of that, but it doesn't operate in a vacuum. So you need to also have a PHA at some point that considers like where you're actually putting this piece of equipment at your facility. Yeah. And then they also highlighted the lack of procedures. So there were no written procedures for operation or maintenance of the immersion freezer. This blew my mind. They said in the report that like normally when they would get a piece of equipment, you know, it would come with all this vendor information, which I think makes good sense. But they said that they were relying so heavily on the Messer engineers that they were not really ever provided with any written information about this piece of equipment that they were leasing from them. So when they didn't have procedures, then that's why they were having difficulty with their maintenance troubleshooting it. That's why they were, you know, maybe unaware of some of the potential hazards.
When you've got one of these arrangements where an equipment vendor is owning the equipment, but it is operated and installed in someone else's location, it's really critical that you have clearly defined responsibilities for who does those written procedures for operation and maintenance. Obviously, Messer owned the equipment, but Foundation Food Groups operated it. So, you know, somewhere between the two, they needed to have that responsibility and action taken, and it fell through the cracks.
Definitely. And then another issue with not having a process safety management program is they didn't have any management of change where they were, you know, assessing the risk when they changed from ammonia refrigeration to liquid nitrogen. So if they had had like a robust management of change procedure, then they would have hopefully thought about some of these things that later became contributing factors. They would have thought a little bit more about what could have gone wrong in the new hazards that were being introduced, because that's what management of change does a good job at when it's done correctly. And then kind of related, but training. So the workers were not trained on the safety hazards of liquid nitrogen and also how to respond to any incidents associated with this new freezer system. And they actually didn't even have warning signs. So the HAZCOM signs, which again is crazy to me, they did right. not have those installed. So it's
they
very
had
possible.
Them, they but did they were have in them. A folder with the vendor information.
Yes, yes, I did see that in the report. So yeah, so they didn't have any signage on this freezer system where it would show you that like this posed an
asphyxiation hazard.
I know, I can't say it. Asphyxiation hazard. So definitely could have done better on the communication piece and the training piece.
Right.
There is another piece here. I know we are very far down the list of contributing factors, but
there was a lot here.
Yeah, there's another big one. So can you tell us about the product stewardship part?
So when you have equipment vendors and suppliers like Messer that designed and built this freezer system, and they actually even owned it, they were just leasing it to Foundation Food Group, you've got a shared responsibility, as we talked about. The American Chemistry Council, ACC, has a program called Responsible Care that's designed to facilitate work with customers, carriers, suppliers, distributors, and contractors for the safe use of chemicals. And it's a very good program that helps facilitate that communication and teamwork among the suppliers and the users for these chemicals. And in this case, Messer had the knowledge and expertise with working with the equipment, the immersion freezer, and the hazards of liquid nitrogen. And they should have worked more closely with Foundation Food Group to ensure that they complied with those safety practices. As you mentioned, they pointed out several times that Foundation Food Group should have had those area sensors for the oxygen content, but they didn't communicate that forcefully enough to ensure that that safety precaution was taken. So when Messer had the knowledge and expertise and noticed poor safety practices, they should have done more follow-up. They could have even gone to the extent of ceasing supply of the liquid nitrogen, which was the source of the hazard, until the Foundation Food Group facility and management and personnel could safely work with that. So the CSB identified this product stewardship as a key issue when you've got a blended relationship like this, and especially when you have one partner to the relationship that has a lot more knowledge and expertise than the other one. The responsibility really falls upon them to share that knowledge and ensure that their materials are handled safely.
Yes, exactly. So after this investigation, the CSB did come up with some recommendations. So they came out with 12 recommendations. We're not going to go through them specifically because they all touch on what we've already talked about here today, but we encourage you to go look at them if you are curious. So the recommendations were made to Gold Creek because that's the current owner of the facility. There were also some recommendations made to Messer, which is of course the equipment supplier and owner in this case. There were also recommendations made to OSHA, CGA, which is the Compressed Gas Association, the NFPA, and the International Fire Code. So again, we touched on most of these issues already, but if you would like to see the detailed recommendations, they are in the CSB report. They're at the very beginning. So on page 10, they're also again at the end. So page 102. So this is the part of our incident breakdown episodes where we like to kind of broaden our view here and talk about what can companies learn from this incident. So obviously there's going to be some learnings here that are very specific to handling the same types of materials. So if you've got a very similar process at your facility, obviously there's going to be learnings here. But we also like to talk about learnings that are a little bit broader to hopefully prevent this type of incident or any sort of incident across industries and facilities. So Molly's going to kick
us
off.
There's a lot that people can learn, even if they're not freezing poultry products from this incident investigation. And so we want people to apply these broader suggestions to their own processes where it makes sense. Absolutely. So the first item we wanted to bring up is the fact that processes that handle hazardous chemicals need to have robust safeguards such that a single component failure won't result in a catastrophic incident. In this case, that single bubbler took out the normal process control and their safety interlock, and they didn't have additional safeguards in place. So once that level bubbler was gone and no longer functional, they had nothing to prevent this incident from happening. So if you've got the potential for a significant or catastrophic consequence, you need to have multiple layers of protection, independent protection layers or IPLs or safeguards to keep you from reaching that severe consequence.
Definitely. And if you've got a good PHA, that will help you identify
those
where
exactly.
You've got issues where you are currently, you know, relying on one single component, which is not a good thing. So definitely a good learning here. Another learning is if you handle hazardous gases or cryogenic asphyxiants, really should have atmospheric monitors installed. So you should be continuously monitoring. You need to have visual and audible alarm systems. Like Molly mentioned, that continuous monitoring piece means that someone outside of that area needs to receive the data at all times so that they are aware of what's going on. Obviously, you also need to have those sensors and alarms properly designed, installed, and then continue to maintain them, inspect them, and test them so that they are ready to go all the time.
Right. Usually companies will have these signals showing up in their control room or, you know, HMI, human machine interface. But you also would want to have local alarms, horns, audible, and often flashing lights to notify anybody walking by or near the vicinity if they can't see the control room data so that everybody that may be impacted will know about that when it's a hazardous condition.
Right. And it would give you the time to leave or the heads up to not enter before it reaches a concentration where, you know, after you breathe once or twice, there's really nothing that can be done.
Yeah, so with those oxygen sensors, typically those alarm points are set at the 19.5%, which is where you just start seeing adverse impacts. And it should give you a lot of leeway before you get down to that 10 to 12% where one or two breaths is fatal. Yeah. So, yeah, those should give you a heads up. Another item is, as I mentioned earlier, the emergency stops. Make sure that they're not just near the equipment, but you also want additional triggers placed in locations that don't require you to enter the danger zone, typically at entrances and exits.
Definitely. Yeah, we talked when we were preparing for this episode about how this reminded me a lot of other incidents we see where, you know, something is controlled by like a manual valve and the spot to turn it off or turn it is, you know, right where everything is happening. Maybe there's a major fire or like that's where the explosion took place or something like that. And same with this case, you know, the e-stops were in the room that they should not access at this point because it was a fatal environment. So definitely thinking about where to put e-stops, how to remotely or at least further away from something be able to stop the process if something is going on. Where do you need to do that? Another learning from this incident is that, you know, safety leadership begins with management. So it's essential to have competent staff. It's essential to have resources. So we talked about how that position was vacant for a long time. Maybe if someone competent in that position had been there during this project, maybe they would have, you know, asked for a better PHA. Maybe they would have thought of some of the issues that ended up contributing to this. So mm-hmm. it's really important to have the resources in place to really give process safety the consideration that it deserves. Because, exactly. I mean, if you've got hazardous stuff at your facility, then your employees deserve that. And of course, there's also lots of other benefits yep. to production and your assets not being damaged, things like that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we always like to touch on PHAs, the process hazard analysis. You need to make sure that that PHA is specific to the process and the facility. Don't take shortcuts and use a generic PHA that says, okay, here's a PHA for process XYZ, and we may put it in six different locations. It really is a review of the process and the equipment and the facility all working together. And some of the safeguards, as we noted in this case, were the area monitors that weren't specific to the equipment, they were specific to the location. So make sure that your PHA is robust and up to current expectations to properly manage your risk.
Yeah, I think this is a good takeaway for anybody that is going to receive a PHA as part of like a vendor package. You know, they may have made some assumptions in that PHA that you would have certain things at your facility. And then again, you know, you really should do another PHA that is just specific to how you'll actually be right. installing it, operating it.
Yeah. One other thing with this one is that we talked about Messer had the knowledge and expertise of the nitrogen hazards and the freezer, and Foundation Food Groups didn't, but they were the ones operating it. So what ideally should have happened is when they were nearing completion of that installation, Foundation Food Groups should have conducted a PHA and had Messer, who has the major knowledge base, participate with them in that PHA and have it done jointly with both groups involved specific to that installation.
Yeah, definitely. And then another learning here was, you know, just ensure that all personnel are trained on the hazards and safety systems associated with handling hazardous materials. So like we mentioned a few times, it doesn't seem like these employees were really aware of the hazards posed by liquid nitrogen. So that contributed to a lot of mm-hmm. the unnecessary fatalities in rescue attempts and things like that.
Right. And then the last thing we wanted to leave people with is that the governmental regulations like OSHA's PSM or EPA's RMP standards should be looked at as the minimum requirements, not the complete package. And even if you have a material that isn't specifically covered by those standards, it still behooves you to consider whether you need a process safety program, regardless of the regulatory requirements. As was the case here, they were handling liquefied nitrogen. It isn't considered a hazardous chemical on either of those two standards, but it obviously does pose significant hazards, and it should have been followed. The other piece of that is that sometimes folks think of hazardous chemicals and their mind goes to things like oil refineries and major chemical plants and plastics manufacturers and things like that. You need to keep in mind that other industries may also need process safety programs and that they have hazardous materials like this is food processing. You may also have pharmaceuticals, a whole variety of things, cosmetics, flavors, fragrances. They may use hazardous solvents and things of that sort. So process safety covers a lot of ground and it's beyond the regulatory boundaries where you might need that.
All right. Well, if you've got a comment about our episode today, or you have an idea for a future episode you'd like to hear, or maybe you just have a question about something process safety related, please reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. So you can send us a voice message using the link in our episode description, or you can send an email podcast@amplifyconsultants.com.
Right. And we wanted to give a shout out again to the Chemical Safety Board, the CSB. We appreciate their excellent work on this report and many, many others. They have done a fabulous job in the last year and a half, clearing their backlog of old reports. They do an excellent job of allowing those of us in industry to learn from the mistakes of others so that we don't have to keep repeating the same problems over and over again. So we encourage you to check out the CSB website at csb.gov, and you can find this Foundation Food Group's report along with many others on that website. Encourage you to read the full report. If any of this information strikes your interest or you think it has applicability to your facility, we urge you to go ahead and read the full report.
Definitely. And we'll be sure to link to this specific report in the show notes so you can go check it out after you take a listen. And finally, our goal here at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by partnering with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create world-class process safety systems, as it's our firm belief that these systems will help to prevent catastrophic incidents like fires, explosions, and toxic releases. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us if we can help guide you on your process safety journey.
Great. Thank you for listening, everyone. And until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.